Leadership shouldn't be about who speaks the loudest, but rather who speaks the truest. I'm Charlotte Otto. Welcome to Speech Bubbles, the podcast that's rewriting the rulebook on leadership, communication, and success. In every episode, we're bursting the bubbles of traditional leadership, bringing you raw, real conversations with trailblazers who don't just challenge the status quo, they obliterate it. We're talking to heads of communication who know the power of words, HR mavericks reshaping workplace culture, and leaders from backgrounds that have been silenced for far too long. This is where vulnerability meets strategy, where authenticity beats artifice, where diverse voices don't just speak, they roar. Whether you're climbing the corporate ladder or building your own, Speech Bubbles is your roadmap to leadership that's human, powerful, and unapologetically you. Are you ready to transform how you communicate, lead, and succeed? Then let's burst some bubbles. My guest today is Dr. Michael Gerhardt. Dr. Michael Gerhardt is an author, computer scientist, communications advisor, public speaker, toy licensor, children's book series creator, podcaster, and guitarist. He began his professional career in computer science, but found himself more drawn to conversations than code. And he noticed that teams didn't get stuck because a problem was complex, but because language was. Later, he moved into toy licensing and co-created the children's book series The Gumball Troll, which became an international bestseller. Working with artists, writers, and companies across borders showed him how people light up when a message feels simple and true. It also showed him how much care and precision it takes to make something look effortless. As the author of The Path to Strategic Impact and host of the podcast Irresistible Communication, he shines a light on great communication. Michael says that the right words can open doors, light people up, and suddenly make things possible that felt stuck before, while the wrong ones can do the opposite, leaving people confused, unmoved, or even resistant. He says at the heart of his work is one simple belief: clarity creates progress. Dr. Michael Gerhardt, welcome to Speech Bubbles.
Hello, Charlotte. It's so great to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us today. So from one word person to another, I feel like you're the ideal Speech Bubbles guest. And I'd love you to talk about how the right words can light people up and make things possible.
That's a great question. So, well, maybe it brings us back to where I started. Because like, as you said in the intro, so I'm originally a computer scientist. So the kind of guy who you would not immediately think of when thinking of like being a great communicator, right? It's supposed to be the people who run away screaming when somebody talks to them and like hide away from every opportunity to speak. And so when I did my PhD in that field, it was the time of the mobile phone revolution. And that saw many ideas like change the world. Like everyone has a smartphone today. But what I found more interesting was how many of those great ideas, brilliant ones even, didn't see the light of day simply because no one cared for finding better words. People thought that a brilliant idea would sell itself on their own. They would be frustrated with the inferior idea getting all the spotlight and like the natural-born salesman stealing the show when obviously like their idea was so much superior. But what really happened was that what they labeled the natural-born salesman, they cared for finding words that made the complex feel simple, the difficult feel easy, that resonated on an emotional level with their audience. In other words, that made other people care just as much, if not more, for the idea than themselves. And so the brilliant guy just went back to the drawing board, trying yet another brilliant idea, which saw the same fate because yet again they threw the boring PowerPoints on the projector rather than caring for finding simpler words, words that made people care. And so that happens when people see themselves in the idea, when they see that someone wants me to like engage in that idea, like when I see how that matters to my personal life, then I'm open to engaging in that idea. And the best part is that I can stop persuading because, well, as soon as it resonates, the idea and the action takes care of itself.
Yeah, so what I'm hearing is simplicity doesn't take away from the complexity of the idea, but it just creates an emotional magnet that helps people to attach better.
Exactly. So in my experience, that is one of the most common misconceptions I've ever seen. Like that whole idea that complexity would be the opposite, if not the enemy, of simplicity. Like those were sitting on two sides of a story. To me, that couldn't be further from what I've seen in my experience. Like, to me, simplicity is what makes complexity accessible. It's more like the entrance. If I want to engage with a complex problem, I need to find a way to make that complexity accessible, and that is through simple language. If I want to spark interest for someone into a complex field, it's through a simple example, a simple metaphor, a simple first, let's call it quick win, that lights them up and that compels them to engage in a deeper conversation. And that's when we get to explore the complexity. It's not like we would dismiss it or pretend that it wouldn't be complex. It's that we make it accessible through simple words.
Yeah, and I love that you said metaphor, because I really think metaphors are open doors in people's hearts and minds, because excuse me, gives people a way to understand things better.
Yeah, I mean, for us who are deeply expert in what we're talking about, who spend our whole days and sometimes even nights thinking about the problem, all of it makes perfect sense. But for someone who's new to that idea, let's pick the mobile phone examples, who's never seen like a handoff of a mobile phone from one base station to the other, or who has no idea what an ad hoc network is, the thing that I wrote my PhD on. Like, I cannot explain that to you using computer science terms. I need to find a way that translates it to things and concepts that are familiar to you, that you know how to deal with or how to like wrestle with from your experience. And actually, so one of my favorite examples here is the German TV show Die Sendung mit der Maus, the show with the mouse, which is hilariously, it's a children's series, but the average viewer age is above 30 years, because parents and also grandparents love to watch it because they master that. They in every episode, they will explain some concept from industry, from economics, from science, and explain it in simple terms. And that's exactly what they do. They use a metaphor, a simple example from everyday life. And only when you get that, they will say, so in reality, this means like this abstract concept. And when you explain the abstract concept, people already know what to think, already know where to put it and where to attach it to in their brains.
Yeah, it's a lovely example. So let's talk about language in terms of business. And your book, The Path to Strategic Impact, was published last year. Mm-hmm. And in it, you say it's not about having great ideas, but about communicating them and communicating them well. And you define the path that turns strategic communications into a decision-making tool. Will you break down the path for us?
That was just a lucky coincidence that I stumbled upon that concept, which happens to be an acronym, which stands for four basic principles, which help you to communicate strategy. But not only that, I believe that this is a concept that actually applies to many other fields of communication as well. So, and they stand for four basic principles, and they are, first is P, plain and simple. So can you find words that the people you're communicating with actually understand without like wrestling them, without having to look up in the dictionary, that just makes sense for the people you're trying to reach? But then, is it not only plain, and so do they not only understand it, but do they know how to act on it? So what does it mean for the actions that or the choices that they need to take in their everyday life? But they will only do so if the third principle is met. So is it transformative? Do they believe you that it's that it brings them to a meaningful place, that it actually makes a difference? Or is it just like boring tasks that keep the old game alive? And H is heartfelt. So is it something that both you and the other person wholeheartedly believe in, something that you truly believe in about things that you deeply care about? And so ideally you would try to align the business goals with the personal goals of the team. And if you meet those four criteria, plain and simple, actionable, transformative, and heartfelt, my experience is that your chances of actually making an impact and actually getting people to act have increased incredibly.
And are you seeing that in action with your clients and the folks that you're speaking to?
Well, that is actually a result of my work with clients. Well, because that was a question that we faced so often in my work with clients, that, well, there's this brilliant idea. Often it was a strategy, and like everyone has had that experience. Everyone who's in the corporate world knows like that experience when leadership team comes back from the strategy retreat, and well, everyone feels enthusiastic and pumped, and well, this time we actually nailed it. This time, well, this is going to change the world. And well, they ask comms to come up with a huge campaign with some nice posters, and there's going to be a town hall where it's announced, and everyone leaves it, yeah, enthusiastic, because it was a big show. But then, like three weeks later, nothing's really changed, and 3 months later, everything's forgotten. And so we simply try to find a solution for that. And we what we found is that often it's like this ambition to make it sound grandiose, like to artificially motivate the team for something that wasn't perhaps worth rallying a team behind. And that becomes obvious the moment you skip the fancy words. You try to say it in plain and simple language, because that exposes the flaws in your thinking, the flaws in your strategy. And rather than fix it through fancy words, it's much better to fix the actual problem and then use plain and simple words to tell a true story about what you discovered.
Yeah, and comms people listening in will love that, because you know, so often comms is brought in after the fact, and then as we start to try and write it up, that's when we expose the flaws, you know, both in the logic but also in the storytelling. So it's a very real and visceral experience that I've been through myself that you're pointing to. So you co-created a children's book, and you've also written a business book. And I love hearing authors talk about their writing process. What was the process of writing last year's book like for you, and what did you learn from it?
Well, that was actually my second business book, and both of them were very different experiences. Like last year's book, The Path to Strategic Impact, felt like, well, it was just an idea that was waiting to get out. I mean, I'm perhaps to understand the full picture here, you need to understand that I'm writing a daily blog for many, many years. So I'm a very regular and very very frequent writer. So and that means I have tons of material, but I have also, so the reason I do that is because it helps me make sense of things. So and so what that means in terms of a book is that I've thought through many questions from many different angles, because my ambition is to, with every post that I put out, to bring a new perspective, to bring something that I haven't written before. And so when I combine that, well, like with that realization that, well, there's so many of my clients struggling with that same problem. And the moment like I saw that acronym, which has that brilliant double meaning when you apply to strategy, like the path we are on, we're already headed, and then the meaning of the acronym parts, basically it fell into places. I've had all the examples from my work with clients where I try to explain those concepts using the examples that you now find in the book, like for Southwest or FedEx, how they apply those principles without naming them like that, but still it's the same principles. And, well, it felt like I just needed to write it down.
And what was the process of the first book?
Well, that was something that that needed to be created. So, so I knew what I wanted to say, but it was at a time where I didn't have as much experience as I do today, and where I needed to wrestle much more with the concept and like stitching the pieces together into a form where it actually makes sense for the reader, where it actually takes them on a journey that makes sense, like start from a place where it makes them curious, where it's, to speak in what we started with, a simple entrance, and then like gradually engage them into deeper ideas about creating that aha effect, the title of the book. So that required much more like that initial like bringing ideas together, and then just writing and sweating the details.
Just back to your blog, do you write in English and German and both?
I started to write in German when I started my business, but I switched like 5 years ago, and I write in English ever since.
And where can folks find the blog? It's not on LinkedIn, is it?
Well, you can read it. My LinkedIn posts are often basically the blog posts, but you can also like just head over to my website, michaelgerhartz.com/newsletter, and write my daily blogs there, or just subscribe to it to get it to your inbox each day.
It's an incredible discipline to write every single day. I'm feeling kind of envious as you're talking. How have you managed to keep that going?
Well, as I said, it's in a way, it's a purely selfish discipline. It's how I make sense of things. So in my experience, and that has served me ever since I learned that back in school, thanks to a brilliant physics teacher that I had, that clear thinking is fueled by clear writing. So if your thinking feels unclear, if you feel like you haven't fully understood a concept, writing about it and trying to find the right words helps to clarify those. Because the moment, so my ambition is not to like write perfect drafts in one sitting. So I will just write down my thoughts, and then I will like tweak it and refine it until it feels true. And that process is invaluable to me. Like even if the thought itself is raw, just putting it into on paper or onto my screen, like forces me to commit to one way of saying it. And the moment you do that, like your gut can kick in and like inform you whether that feels right. Your brain can wrestle with it, whether the logic is right. And only if those two things like click together, if it makes sense and it feels right, then it's a done piece. And that means that, at least to me, the story that I tell myself is that's something that I understood a little better.
Yeah, and a lot of people do write a journal, but to post on a daily basis, you know, live to the world is, I think, pretty courageous. So congratulations to you.
Yeah, I mean, the nice second effect of that is that you get immediate feedback. Like people will engage with that, and they will point it out to you when it really doesn't make sense to them, or when it upsets them. And then like you can wrestle with it yet again, and like to try to understand, so do they have a point? Did I like upset them for a reason, or was it just that I reached them at the wrong point in the wrong room? Or what is going on here? Or is there a real flaw in my thinking? So then I can really refine it once again.
Yeah, so you're prepared to be learning out loud and in public, which is courageous, but it also does get you to clarity and simplicity, which are two fantastic goals. Now, you just said that you've switched to writing in English. You're also podcasting, I think, in English, so your second language. Also, huge respect from me. What sits behind your love of reading and writing in English?
So, I mean, English was a thing since forever when I was back in school, when the English music channels were available on cable TV in Germany, but there was no good like music television in German. So that was my first exposition with English. But then ever since I've began my professional career, so in computer science, there just is no literature in German. It just doesn't exist. So if you wanted to engage in any deeper research, you had to consume it in English. And if you wanted to discuss your idea with fellow researchers, you had to do it in English. And so, like, since I started my career in computer science, it was clear that my professional life would be in English. I still worked mainly in Germany, so that's why I set up my consulting business on communication in German when I started. But then once the pandemic hit in 2020, like, it was like, I mean, what point is it in doing it in German when, like, the problems are the same whether you're sitting in New York or in Cologne, whether you're in Düsseldorf or in Sydney? And so, like, if we're just two screens communicating with each other, then I can just as well expand to international services. And then that made sense to just do it in English.
So it was quite a natural move for you.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. So, Michael, you've described your career path as nonlinear. And I want to briefly just tap into the world of toys. What led you there?
Well, that was something that certainly wasn't on my bucket list as a teenager, or even in my 20s or something. It happened by pure accident, through a hobby of my wife. When our youngest daughter was born, she had some friends who asked her to help them out with some sewing problems. And that's when she started to, like, give workshops about sewing and doing it yourself stuff. And she's a very creative person, and she quickly started to design her own designs. And some of those were so sweet and cute and adoring that, well, I remember the day when we sat in our garden and said, well, that deserves to be bigger than just a sewing pattern. So we just, well, we shot a video with our kids and some friends' kids, sent it to one of the largest German toy manufacturers and said, hey, here's a new idea. How do you like it? And, well, a day after, they wanted to see prototypes. A week after, their managing director sat down in our living room to negotiate a worldwide licensing deal. And that was basically that. And so we were perhaps a little bit naive then to think that, well, what works once could happen twice. And, well, that's exactly what happened. So we send another idea to another manufacturer, and then a third, and then a fourth. And suddenly, we were out of nowhere. There was that couple from close to Cologne flooding the German toy market with new toys, each one with a TV spot. So all of them became actually pretty huge. And so we're very fortunate that we managed to land like four, or was it five? I'm not exactly sure. Licenses that really touched children's hearts, and like the Sleepy Cats, they became an international hit, like even being sold in the United States, and the Grumble Troll is an international bestseller. It's one of the most favorite German children's books. It's been translated in, I think, like 20 languages or so. And yeah, so that's something that we've been incredibly lucky with, but also very happy about, that we managed to put so many smiles on so many children's faces.
What I'm hearing as a sort of common parallel through your story is this constant relationship between, you know, science and creativity. So doing things scientifically or thinking logically through things, but also bringing emotions and creativity, which is also something you do with your music, the combination of the two. And I can imagine that living both must be extremely satisfying as a human.
It is, but it is actually something that took me quite a long time to actually see myself and embrace. Because, back in the university, I didn't really see that. Even back in school, I always thought of myself as that rational guy, that guy who knows how to think things through. I was good at maths, I was good at physics, and even the way that I played the guitar, that was more technical than emotional when I started. And it took me quite a while to see that connection, and I think that the guitar really played a huge role, but also my kids played a huge role in seeing how those two sides together are so much stronger than either can be alone. That something that makes sense, that's logically sound, structurally solid, but that also feels right, warm, inviting, that resonates on a deeper level than just like making sense, that's so much more fulfilling.
Yeah, it takes us right back to the beginning where we were talking about that combination of emotion and rational, which is so lovely. So where in your path, your interesting, non-linear path that's been one of growth and becoming more and more creative, where have you learned the most about leadership?
I think what had a very interesting impact on myself was the way that people who didn't have a formal leadership role led, like the mentors I had back at the university, who weren't like in any way in a formally higher role than I was. They were just perhaps like a step ahead of myself, but they never again like took the responsibility to take care of the people around them, to help them see what they already saw, to help them avoid the traps that they fell into, and to help them find their path perhaps a little lighter and easier than they themselves had to find it.
So you experienced and witnessed really great mentorship, is what you're saying?
Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
Yeah. And what was it unique about that? Was it just shining the light or lightening the load? What made it stand out?
I wouldn't call it lightening the load, because while I was inside, it perhaps even felt like the opposite. Like that mentorship was a very demanding one. Like we were pushing each other for better, for more rigorous thinking. But it also like helped shine a light, or it often shone a light on the things that I had a blind spot on, or that I couldn't see because I hadn't fallen into that trap yet. So it wasn't exactly lighter. It was driven by a passion, I would call it, a passion to be rigorous in the research that we did, like to really find out truths that hold a deeper diligence, like that you could like investigate and shake and it still holds. And so that passion flipped over to helping the people who came after you do this. First of all, do the same, but also it helped yourself like to become a better researcher, because it helped you understand the things better. And sometimes we were collaborating on the same problem. So helping others become more rigorous and ambitious like often pushes you yourself forward to higher places.
Oh, absolutely. Such a lovely answer. Now, another topic you know I'm passionate about is diversity. What resonance does diversity have for you?
It's a strange resonance for me in the sense that I never really understood like how there can be a different way to that. Like, I mean, who cares for where people come from, which color of their skin there are, which passions they have, what they believe privately, when all that matters is that together we make progress, like together as a group, as a team, if not as a society. Whoever has the better question is the one who should be heard, and whose voice should be amplified, because that hopefully leads us to find better answers.
Yeah, that's a really strong scientist's answer. The person who has the great question. And now, as a communications advisor and an author, podcaster, someone who's writing a newsletter, blogging on a daily basis, how do you think about your own reputation?
So I would think I should probably, I could probably care more about so the actual reputation. But so there are a couple of values that I hold strongly and dearly. And I think, or let's call it, I hope that they have an impact on how people see me. And one is, and so they could perhaps be summarized as honesty, empathy, and trust. So I try to be honest in the sense that, like, well, for example, I hate bullshit, and I hate it when people just announce or assert something that they haven't thought through just to, like, get to where they want to go. And I'm more interested in a truthful answer and a truth and a rigorous approach. I also think it's important that we consider the other side. That we look at, so how do people hear what we have to tell, whether they have the knowledge, the experience, the capacity to understand what we want them to understand or what they need to understand to see what we're trying to say. And then trust in that we should trust our audiences to come to their own conclusions, that we lay it out as we see it, and we do our best to make it as easy to see from their perspective, but then we trust them with making the decision whether to approve of the message or not, whether to agree with us or to disagree, whether to buy the product or not, whether to embrace the idea or not.
So you act according to your values and trust that if you do that, your reputation takes care of itself.
In a way, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a similar answer in my... It's either the second or third interview I ever did on Speech Bubbles from a brilliant leader called Sarah Dorr. And she's very concerned with her reputation because she's the CEO of several businesses. But she just said to me, I know what my values are. I trust myself to act according to my values. So I believe that my reputation takes care of itself. And it was such a beautiful, simple answer to something that sometimes feels very mm-hmm. complex. So it was lovely to hear you not repeat that, but echo that with your own interpretation. So you also know that my big passion is we have this old leadership archetype in our heads. I'm trying to change that with the work I do, both with We Need New Leaders and this podcast. What do you think we can do both collectively and individually to change the old leadership archetype we have in our heads?
I would think that... Well, I think I would like to repeat something that I already said. Like, if we would ask more questions rather than have answers. So in other words, if we tried less to be right and tried more to get it right, then we'd be better off individually and as a collective. Like if we didn't spend so much time defending our takes and rather spend the time understanding other person's takes, that would have a very positive effect on the world.
Yeah, that's such a beautiful answer. And it speaks to the simplicity and the emotions and the clarity that we were talking about earlier in the podcast, but it also speaks to how we break down the divisions in society, right? That if people yeah. spend less time trying to defend their own take, so be right, and spend more time trying to understand the opinions of others, so getting yeah. it right, exactly. we'd be in a different place in the world. Exactly. A very simple answer, Michael, but with a very deep resonance. So thank you so much for that. And now we get to the questions I always ask. Give us a book recommendation.
If it has to be one, it must be The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend you do. It's really my favorite book of all time. And I think despite its age, it couldn't be more timely because, well, it reflects what I just said, like, I mean, despite like that just brilliant surgeons on what's going on in society and why society is going sideways in so many ways, which were true in the 80s when it was published and are still true today, I think the climax of the book just well, is just such a phenomenal and accurate picture of what's going on today, in a way mirroring what I just said earlier. I'm sorry to spoiler, so if you haven't read it and want to keep it, I think you've heard it before. Like, skip the next 30 seconds. But like this, the climax of the book is when that huge supercomputer, after millions of years of computing, reveals the question to the ultimate, the answer to the ultimate question of life, universe, and all the rest. It turns out to be 42. To huge disappointment of the whole crowd who's desperately waiting for that answer. And to me, that is just such an accurate depiction of our time. Like it feels like there are 42s everywhere, and like answers and opinions on pretty much everything, strongly held, heavily defended, without ever taking the time to pause and ask yourself, so wait a second, what was the question again? So what is the ultimate question of life, universe, and the rest? What is the question that we're trying to answer in our team, in this project, for that product, in this meeting? So that would be helpful. And yeah, it's just hilariously written, and Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is the book.
Yeah, I think I read it back in the 80s. It's probably due for a reread, for
it
sure.
So
in terms of new leaders coming into jobs, new leadership roles, or ambitions to have a leadership role, or want to create their own businesses where they lead, what three tips do you have for them?
I would say the first is to step off the hero's pedestal. Like, trying to be the smart, or being the smart guy, was perhaps what brought you here. It's not what keeps you here and what people need from you now. Like, if you're still the smartest person in the room, you might want to reconsider how you set up your team. And to me, a very brilliant way of capturing that is Scott Kelly, the former ISS commander-in-chief, who once said that the smartest person is usually the person in the room who knows how to tap into the brilliance of everyone. And so that's your job. Which brings me to the second, something that I've said multiple times during the conversation. You don't have to have the answers. That is an ancient model of leadership, that you would have to be the one who like has to know how everything works, has to figure it out if no one else does, and who has to command your team on what to do. Like, that's not the most successful way of running a team anymore. It's much more important, rather than to like have all those answers yourself, tap into the brilliance, light the path so that we're all aligned on that path, so that everyone can surface their brilliance and bring it and figure out the questions and the answers as a team together. And the third would be that plain and simple always beats grandiose. Like, we often think about the movie version of a leader who steps up, has that big vision, using grandiose words. But in my experience, what often rallies a team behind you much more effectively is the plain and simple language. The simple way of capturing a complex truth, of capturing a messy world in what feels like a simple statement that makes sense for us as a team and that feels right for us to rally behind.
Yeah, those are lovely tips. And I feel like you gave me my episode title there, which is, you don't need to know all the answers. And last question. It's pretty dark in Germany today. November is upon us. Mm-hmm. Winter is coming. What brings you joy?
Playing the guitar. What one thing? I mean, there are many, but playing the guitar is the thing that I do if I have a spare minute, but also like if like the emotions call for it. Well, you start playing and you always leave the instrument happier than when you took it and started playing.
What a lovely answer. So the message here is, keep it simple. You don't need all the answers. Such a lovely interview. Thank you, Dr. Michael Gerhardt. If you enjoyed this episode, please do follow Speech Bubbles to get new episodes as they land on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please tell all your friends. And if you're interested in the ideas in this podcast around reputation, leadership, and diversity, you'll probably enjoy my book, We Need New Leaders, which is available online and in all good bookstores. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.